Teddy Wayne, who's the author of the novels Loner, The Love Song of Johnny Valentine, Capitoil, and you've got a new novel coming out called Apartment, right?
Yeah, in 2020.
Is there anything you want to add to your bio?
No, let's go take it from there. Longtime friend of Lev Moscow's.
Yeah, thank you for coming over here in the October heat. It must be 85 degrees out today. I'm excited you're here. We're going to talk today about the economics of being a writer. I guess I'd like to start with, take me back to college. At what point did you realize that you wanted to be a writer? And what steps did you take in the last couple of years of college to make that happen?
I realized it well before college, probably in grade school. But in college, I was an English major, and I didn't take any creative writing classes. I tried to get into some and didn't get in. But I was working on things on my own. I was working on a lot of screenplays back then, which is something I've only professionally broken into this past few months. So it took 20 years to get there. But I was an English major, read a lot of literature, wrote critical essays, wrote a thesis, but otherwise was not writing that much fiction, maybe a little bit. So I was doing, I think of it sort of the way I just watched The Karate Kid recently, where this is a more obvious and direct relationship, but he's doing all these other exercises, waxing the car and so on, that he only realizes later pay off when he's actually doing karate. And I do feel like, obviously, the relationship is, again, more direct, but reading literature, writing critical essays, you're not writing fiction, but it's preparing you for the work of writing fiction later on.
Okay, so you graduate from college, and what happens next? Do you get a normal job and then write on the side?
No, I did not. I've never had a full-time, no end in sight normal job. I've always had freelance work. After college, I wrote Spark Notes and there for another competitor of theirs for a while. I tutored. I did copy editing. Then I went to graduate school. I wrote a novel on my own when I was about 24, 25. With that novel, I got an agent, but was not able to sell it. But it did get me into graduate school for an MFA, Master's of Fine Arts in Fiction Writing. And a lot of MFA programs actually pay you to go. Not only do you not have to pay tuition, but you'll get a stipend too. So I went to one of those schools.
So is it worth it for someone to go to an MFA program? What do you think about that?
Only if either you have tons of family money and you can afford it, or for everyone else, if they pay for you, this situation I had. And I don't know the numbers, but the better schools, there's probably a good several dozen schools out there that will either waive tuition or waive tuition and pay you either usually for teaching work down the road at some point. And I only recommend it for that, even for fiction, especially for poetry, to pay $100,000 for a poetry writing degree. It feels like you're just signing yourself up for a lifetime of misery.
So maybe it makes me think about something that I've been wondering about for a long time. Do you think that the industry and maybe fiction writing in general has a class problem in the sense that it's very difficult? Well, I imagine it'd be pretty difficult for working class people to write books.
Yeah, both for the systemic reasons of you do need, you know, it helps to have more education to some degree to be a better writer, not always necessary, but it certainly helps to have the time and the luxury of time, which you can only have if you have money. So absolutely. Plus, readers of, you know, highbrow fiction tend themselves to come from the upper middle classes. So while they might be voyeuristically or touristically interested in the lives how the other half lives, they're not the natural audience for it. But there are, I think, you know, if you look in an airport at the paperback rack, I think those tend to get probably a wider socioeconomic range of readers. I don't know the exact numbers, but I'm sure that's a wider range than what the New York Times book review is reviewing this week.
How does that impact what's actually published, the class composition, the class makeup of the writers?
Yeah, I think it's what you'd imagine, which is people tend to reproduce what they know or what they're comfortable with. We're also in an era now of people being criticized for straying out of their lane at times and writing about things that they don't have firsthand experience with. So it's making writers even more, I think, scared to go, again, outside of their biographical experience. So they'll reproduce what they know, which is often the lives of the upper middle class in cosmopolitan cities.
But I have to give you credit, at least with regards to the love song of Johnny Valentine and Capitoil, you really did step outside of your own world. Was that, well, one, do you think, am I right to say that? And two, if so, were you nervous about doing that?
No, because that wasn't in the air as much back then. But they all, with Capitoil, it's interesting. It's, maybe I'm opening up a can of worms here, but it is Middle Eastern Muslim computer programmer from Qatar. And I wrote it from 2005 to 2009 or so, and came out in 2010. And I think if it were to be published today, it would probably be in, I'd probably be receiving more criticism for kind of appropriation or writing about a character from a completely different background, especially one that's so marginalized in the U.S. Johnny Valentine, a little bit different. It's a child pop star. I don't think the child pop stars in America we're upset about that.
What about Apartment? Loner, by the way, is about a Harvard grad, and you're sort of
closer to my experience. Yeah. And Apartment, without getting into details, because I'm still editing it, is also closer to my experience. So, yeah, I was, I guess, more daring in my youth.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll use this. You can tell me if we can use this or not. But I remember giving you guys Motherless Brooklyn, and you said something like, well, he didn't live this gangster life, so I'm not sure that I trust the narrative.
I didn't say that. Someone else did.
Someone else did. I won't say too. Do you agree with that sentiment, though?
No, but I think her point was not that he shouldn't be allowed to write about this, but that maybe it felt like a performance rather than lived experience.
So how do you write outside of your own comfort zone, if, or your own world, your own universe, if it's to some extent always going to be a performance, right?
Yeah. So yes, we can either just write diaries, which is a new trend of basically writing memoir.
Have you read My Struggle?
I've read some of it, yeah. And some of it's good, and some of it feels like this is not that challenging. Like it's just navel gazing. I mean, you could do research. You could research and imagination. I don't know any other way. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a difference. You can tell when someone smacks of homework versus this person really got the dirt under their fingernails. Whatever world. It doesn't have to be an impoverished, scary, dangerous world. It can be the world of the Upper East Side. But if you can tell when someone's looking at it as if they're, again, a tourist in that world or an inhabitant.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the story for a sec. You get out of grad school, you went to WashU, you come out, you've got a novel, and what happens next? If you're giving advice now to a young writer, where do you go after that?
Maybe don't move to New York City, which is what I did, because I'm from here, which is expensive, but maybe move. I mean, the advice I've always heard is move somewhere, live somewhere cheap, until you break in, because you don't need to be in New York to publish a novel. Mm-hmm. It could help a little bit. You might make some contacts, but if it's good enough, it'll be good enough whether you're in New York or in Alaska. So in my case, as I recall, I tried to sell that book my third year. I was teaching in grad school one more year after I graduated. I tried to sell that year. It didn't sell. I revised it and I sold it 9 months later when I was in New York. But it wasn't a ton of money, not much at all, really, not even enough on its own to live on for a year after you agent takes 15% and then taxes. So it's like kicking a few days of the week out of the way.
This is a Chris Rock reference.
Yes.
But I've also heard that basically it works out to around minimum wage, right? If you take into account how many years the average novel takes to write and then what you get for your first novel.
It depends what your advance is, but first novel advances from five major publishing umbrella organizations that have a number of imprints, but five, big places. If you publish with one of them, a novel, literary fiction, not a sort of thriller, mystery, something like that, the sort of conventional range would be probably 20,000 would be the floor, and 100,000 is sort of a very nice deal for a first time, not hugely hyped book. And there are, of course, the exceptions that get $500,000, $1 million, and so on. But those are few and far between. So yeah, if you think about it, most books take minimum 3 years of work, maybe not full time, but certainly 3 years at least, all told. Mm-hmm. If you got even $100,000 for it, that's $85,000 after 15%. So it's about, $27,000, $28,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And then you know, how much time do you spend on it? Probably not a full-time job at that point, but that's not a great living. So you have to have something else to supplement, which is why almost all writers teach.
Well, then I guess the next question would be, why in a world that seems, I don't want to say post-literate, but where you don't see many people on the train reading books anymore, and you're not celebrated in the same way that maybe writers would have been 50 or 60 years ago, why do it?
The only reason to do it would be is if you love it, and to an extent, you know, even if you don't love it, if I've refined myself out of all other skills now okay. for the workplace, so this is all I really can do. But no, you have to love it, and if you don't, it's too little money and too agonizing and too unrewarded and by society to mm-hmm. to do it. I used to tell writing students, undergraduates, but maybe even graduate students, you know, only pursue this if it's going to kill you not to pursue it. Mm-hmm. If you could see yourself doing something else that you'd love equally, there's a lot of jobs that the world needs mm. desperately and that do better for the world, I think, usually than writing does. And, you know, it's a difficult job. Most people won't make it financially, so you're setting yourself up for a very strenuous financial existence. And also it's like it can be lonely. You're, you know, in your apartment usually all day mm-hmm. in front of a computer. If you're lucky, if you're successful, you get isolated. Mm-hmm. So most people can't even handle that and wouldn't want to do that. We're social animals. So mm-hmm. if the idea of being in your apartment all day just writing is appealing, then go for it, because it probably means this is what you're to do. But if you find yourself wanting to check the internet or see people a lot, you know, it maybe means it's not the right long-term job for you, and it could be something you do on the side while you do something else. Mm-hmm.
So let's go back to Capitoia. Capitoia was really well received. Did this help you with your next book? What was the next deal like? You don't have to talk about exact numbers, but one question I would have, and I might edit this out a little bit the way we, depending on where we go, but Capitoia didn't sell super well, but it did okay. But it really did really well. So what happens when you come back to the publishing house after having a book like that?
I switched publishers, it was a better deal the next time. It won a few prizes or was nominated for a few prizes or book awards, so that helped mm-hmm. a lot. But, yeah, it wouldn't get a bigger advance than the first one, because the first one was quite low. Mm-hmm. So there's nowhere to go but up, really. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, the critical reception helped. I think it probably sold decently enough that it wasn't like it was a disaster or anything. So mm-hmm. that, you know, I think it was what I hear is you can make the argument often that a book was, quote, underpublished, meaning that the publisher didn't do enough to push it. And you can sort of blame it on them as opposed to the book itself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what my agent was trying to suggest when selling the second one.
Do you think they expected you to sell really well, or do you think that for them just getting the awards was enough? I mean, I guess the question is, do they care if you sell 50,000
yeah,
copies?
They would have loved if I did, but mm-hmm. they were not expecting it to do that. And what I think happens is publishers put their big money on a few horses each mm-hmm. year, both the perennial bestsellers and a few new debuts they think have a chance to really take off. And they throw, for everyone else, they sort of give them table scraps and throw a bunch of it at the wall, see what sticks, and maybe they'll get lucky. So I think Capitoia was certainly in the latter category. I think they were probably happy. I'm sure they made their money back. It makes them look good to have a book that does well critically like that, mm-hmm. but it was never going to be a rampant runaway bestseller. And it's also sort of preordained in the publishing industry, as it is in most artistic industries, in that not only do you need something that is itself good and will resonate with people on a mass level, but the publisher or film company or music label has to really be behind it and push it hard for that to happen too. It rarely is word of mouth, especially these days. Maybe, you know, 10, 20 more years ago, there's more of a chance for sleeper hits, but I think we're currently in an era of sort of like a big business mentality of, if you don't have an Apple or Amazon behind you, you know, you're not going to make it. So likewise, if the publisher doesn't say, this is our big book for the fall, it can't really become the big book for the fall otherwise.
Well, can you talk a little bit about maybe why that happened? What were those changes that happened over the last 20 years?
Well, in books, certainly that people read a lot less than they used to. I've seen different numbers, and mm-hmm. sometimes they suggest it's staying level or whatever, but I think you and I, just anecdotally, absolutely it's the case. I think people read less than they used to. TV and the internet. People can watch a million TV shows now at home. They're higher quality than they used to be. They have, in fact, siphoned off a lot of book writers who used to write novels, or people who maybe would have written novels 30 years ago are now going to TV right away. And they are mimicking the structure of good novels. The Wire is like a Dickensian novel. Mm-hmm. Things like The Wire didn't exist 30 years ago. So it's hard to get people to sit down with a dense, long, complicated book when they can bring up Netflix and watch a 22-minute sitcom or an hour-long serial drama very easily.
Do you think that qualitatively matters for the way we live? Does it matter if people are reading less fiction but instead watching The Wire?
Yeah, I mean, The Wire is the pinnacle of TV, so that's not a great example. I don't want to cite some middle-of-the-road TV show, but yeah, the studies seem to suggest that reading fiction, especially, or reading books, period, but fiction, does improve empathy in a way that I don't think TV shows or films do quite as much, because you get deeply within the perspective of someone else in a way that you can, within the consciousness, too, in a way that film and TV don't do the same way. Mm-hmm. You can see worlds in film and TV more vividly than books might be able to do, but rarely do you get inside the head of someone. And so that does seem to be a major loss for our culture if people are even going to prestige, well-written TV shows over novels.
Yeah, can we talk about this, that you're maybe going to be writing this is a chance to talk about it a little bit, but you're going to be possibly writing a television show, right?
I'm adapting Loner for a network that is, I can't name it yet because it's not public yet, but I am writing a pilot for it. Yeah.
You're a new father. I imagine it's going to be real important for you to make sure that your kid reads a lot. How are you going to make sure that happens? Is there any way to sort of block out the distractions of the telephone and the TV and Netflix?
Yeah, I think that's a lot. I think one thing is my wife and I don't own an iPad, which, and I don't see a need for one. And I think that seems to be a more dangerous gateway drug because it's easier to handle than a laptop. And bigger than a phone, so it seems like toddlers really like them. And when I've seen friends with little kids who own iPads, it seems like the marijuana of screens. So I think not having an iPad is a start. I think modeling good behavior, not being on your phone yourself all the time, so they don't start to be both jealous of it and to see it as a desirable object. Modeling reading from actual print books. I do own a Kindle, so that's not great to do that, but I think I'll try to, we have a lot of books in our home. I've read studies that owning more books independent of other variables increases children's literacy.
If you never read them, as long as they're in your bookshelf.
Yeah, but independent of, but you suggest that you probably do read them, but independent of education, income, those variables taken out, you start to see a big difference around 50 to 80 books, and then up to about 350 books that you own just in the home seems to have some kind of effect on the literacy of the kids. So, yeah, having books, modeling that behavior, and then reading to kids at an early age and not being lazy about it and putting them in front of the TV, which I'm already seeing how that's a temptation. My four-month-old son gets pacified by a certain video that we set him up for to watch.
What's the video?
It's the PS22 in Staten Island, which is, I encourage everyone to watch. It's a kids'
I'll post it on the webpage.
Yeah. Elementary school choir that does cover versions of a lot of songs. They're pretty well known. And their version of 99 Red Balloons, for some reason, he's really into. So he was crying wildly this morning. Mm-hmm. It settled him down. So, but I think that's a dangerous habit to get into because I could see us doing that with TV shows in a few years, instead of trying to work through a tantrum or going to a book in those moments.
Teddy, I'm hungry. I think you're probably hungry too. Let's go get some food.
Watch some Netflix first.